It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis has the day off, but Kevin Marks is here along with Gina Trapani. We'll talk about the issue of completism and how to avoid it. Infinite music loops generated automatically, and the latest for the HTC One. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 201, recorded June 5th, 2013. Patent Crows. This Week in Google is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a new mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay for what you use. Ting doesn't require a contract, and they offer unlimited devices on a single pool plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit twig.ting.com. And by LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom's not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your direction, like affordable business and personal documents you can trust. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code TWIG to get $10 off at checkout. And by 99designs, the world's largest online graphic design marketplace. 99designs connects businesses seeking quality, affordable designs with a community of over 200,000 graphic designers. Visit 99designs.com/twig to receive a free design consultation. It's time for This Week in Google. Twig is on the air. Gina Trapani is here from smarterware.org. She is also the programmer of Think Up, the fabulous Think Up app, and the To Do Text app, and the mother of Etta.
Yes, hello.
All of which are important. Oh, and host of All About Android. It's nice to see you.
Yeah, host of All About Android. See?
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a fun show last night. It's great to be here. Favorite hour of the week.
Because you had the guy who does SwiftKey on, and that's awesome.
Somebody
from SwiftKey. Yeah. Yeah, I love
SwiftKey. I can no longer say this is my favorite hour of the week. It's my second. I have two favorite hours of the week. They're when I do All About Android and then Twig the next time.
I'm loving Android so more and more all the time. Now my biggest problem is whether I should use the GS4 or the HTC One. I go back and forth.
They're both great phones.
Yeah, they really are. Neither is perfect, and both have its pros and cons on both. So it's a difficult choice. Currently carrying the HTC One, and I'm going to talk about that actually a little bit later on. Also with us, Jeff Jarvis is on his way to Thailand, as he mentioned last week. So with us, very graciously filling in from his bird cage, Kevin Marks.
Hi, Dad.
It's good to see you. TunnelVision.tv and Salesforce.com and former Googler, former Appler, former BTer. Great to have you, Kevin. Nice to see you.
Just can't keep a job.
You're just in demand. You're trying to serve everyone.
There we go. I'll take it that far.
I didn't realize this, but I was just looking at your title at Salesforce is what?
Vice President of Open Cloud Standards.
I like that. Open standards.
Yeah.
And that's what you've really promoted all along, hasn't you? Haven't you?
That's what I've been involved with, certainly for the last 10 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
It depends how you define QuickTime. I suppose the 10 years before that, I was spending a lot of time on QuickTime, which was, it was from one company, and I wouldn't fully define it as open, but the file format was a de facto standard at the time. And Apple kind of dropped the ball on that.
Didn't you tell us that you lobbied within Apple to keep it open?
I tried to get more open source codecs and things, and I was trying to get Vorbis and things like that built into it. And they were too frightened of patents at the time to do that. And also, Apple made a fatal mistake of patenting some piece of the file format, and therefore it was then tainted, and people wouldn't use it. So we've lost a lot of the value of that QuickTime had. Well, I was having this conversation at SF Music Tech last week, where we're now trying to come up again with multi-track standards for audio, and the problem is that every standardization that's been done in the last 10 years has been for playback only, not really for mastering. And so we're able to use AIFF, but there isn't a good way to interchange the raw multi-track between different programs
able to oh that's interesting own. So it's not about compression, it's just about the format. But yeah. isn't AIFF, the Apple standard, just pretty much close to here's the bits?
Yes, but the problem is that even though AIFF can train an arbitrary number of tracks, most of the programs will only take two. And so if you're trying to take an entire mix back and forth, it's a lot more fiddly. So one of the guys from Beatport, they're trying to distribute the raw stems for the people creating music so that they can be remixed. And he was saying that they've got a big problem with this because they can distribute them as a giant AFF with all the tracks in, and that works. But when you try and import it to the other programs, they only take the first two. So they have to do some jiggery pokery to make them, to separate them into individual files and then line them up again, which is a bit backwards.
It doesn't take much to understand the value of this. A few bands have, I think Nine Inch Nails distributed the garage band of the tracks, the raw tracks. Yeah. And it's so amazing to hear the individual tracks. There is a bootleg, which I've heard, of tracks from the Beatles' original four-track recordings at Abbey Road, where you can hear the vocal, you can hear each individual instrument, and it's mind-boggling.
Right. Now, this is the thing. So what's happening with, especially with the electronic dance music scene, is that there's a lot of value in remixes and DJs remaking stuff. So what the Beatports guys are trying to do is make it possible to distribute these. And so they're sending out raw audio files. But the way they have to do it is, if you have a sample that's only used in the fourth minute, you have to pad it with silence up to the fourth minute, put the sample in, and then pad it out, and distribute the track like that, which is a little crazy. I mean, it's not the end of the world, but it means that you're throwing gigantic files around for no real reason.
Right.
Whereas what we had with QuickTime was the ability to edit arbitrary files together in time sequence from any source. So you could say, just take this bit and put it at this time and have it sample accurately, drop in and mix.
Yeah.
And that's the piece that we've kind of lost. We haven't got a good format for that at the moment.
So boy, it would be amazing. I mean, imagine buying an album. You can buy the regular album, or you could buy the unmixed album unmix it yourself version. I would just, here I found on studiomultitracks.com, here is Come Together in individual tracks. There's guitar, there's bass, there's vocals, there's drums. Let me just play the vocals. Can you? I don't know if you're getting audio from my. EMI blocked it. Okay.
I heard one.
That's nice.
Yes.
Let me. Wait a minute. No, wait a minute. Here it is. It is on YouTube. They just blocked it on the remote site. I don't know. Maybe Chad, you can't hear me. I don't know. We're having trouble with getting this laptop's.
I saw one yesterday that was. The ISO voice track for Under Pressure.
Oh, I love that. I just love that when you can do that.
Yeah. So that's the thing. But this is, if you're DJing, this is what you need. You need these individual pieces. And there's lots of clever software now that will sit there and try and extract them through frequency filtering and stuff. But obviously it's much better if you can distribute them raw and in pieces. So that's
And we have no format. That's very interesting, yeah.
And we haven't got a good format for it, yeah.
Yeah.
So the problem is that each app has their own.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you kind of have the de facto GarageBand, or Logic, which so many people use that you could use it, but of course it's not an open standard.
Yeah, you've got GarageBand, Logic, you've got Ableton, there's different ones that are used by different people.
Yeah. Well, enough of that, although that's... frankly, very interesting. And I will, maybe Chad can find it. It's on YouTube. Come Together Vocals on YouTube, Chad. Maybe you can play it for us, because it's Come Together Isolated Vocals. I don't know where these came from. Pretty interesting. And I'm sure that we'll get pulled down immediately for playing them.
Yes, quite lazy.
That's the click track.
There we go.
That's a vocal, which I never knew.
Wow.
Here come old Flat Top, he come grooving up slowly, he got juice.
Isn't it great to hear that?
Wow.
Holy roller,
you just feel more intimate.
Down to his knee. Got to be a joker, he just do what he please.
All right, we can stop. But that's John Lennon, obviously, the raw vocal from Come Together. Unbelievable. I tell you, the music industry should solve this, because wouldn't you buy albums this way?
Right. Well, and the other conversation we had was, there's the Neil Young thing, which is, we should create higher quality recordings. But the argument we were having there was, it's the solving the wrong problem. I mean, there's
That's
nothing
playback.
Wrong with distributing high quality mix,
right?
But actually 44 kilohertz stereo is plenty good enough for that. And you can send that uncompressed, or you can send that, you know, with 320 MP3s, and it's still for sound transparent. The difficulty is that everyone's been remixing for headphones, for, you know, in-ear earbuds instead of for proper equipment. So the right answer might be to distribute a track with four different studio engineered mixes.
Right.
So you've got one for I'm wearing headphones, and one for I'm in the car, and one for I'm using my fancy hi-fi equipment, and one that's, you know, that's surround or something like that. And set it up so that you bundle those together and sell that, and then you play back the one that makes sense at the time. So you get the very highly compressed one that's really loud if you're in that situation where you need the extra bass. But if you've actually got, you know, the big over-the-ear can transparent headphones, then you use the good mix instead.
So cool.
That's the other fascinating thing for me is that gigantic headphones are back.
Aren't they?
Yeah.
And you know, the Monster guys were sponsoring SF Music Tech and were pitching theirs. But the fact that my son's gone off on holiday with his girlfriend, and they've taken two gigantic over-the-ear cans and a headphone splitter to.
I fear it's more for style than it is for audio fidelity, however.
It's a bit about, I mean, but at least, you know, the point is that the availability is there.
Right.
You can actually tell the difference between, you know, these things and proper headphones if you're trying to.
Yeah.
And you know, there's more bass in the big ones, which is obviously true because physics, but also there's more dynamic range, and that gets really important. So the fact that you can have, you know, good acoustic isolation and then listen to dynamic range means we may get better mixes back. That's my hope. So that was my sort of music geekery last week.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Kind of a completely different topic from what we were going to talk. But, you know, the truth is there's not any major breaking news anyway after Google I.O. We're kind of in the lull now.
Well, the tying it back to the web is the web audio stuff. So I don't know how much of that you've seen, but the HTML5 web audio is actually really impressive now. They've built an expression language that lets you do multi-channel mixers and synthesizers,
really?
And voice recognition, all kinds of stuff. Yeah. So Chris Wilson from Google was showing that off at SF Music Tech. Have you had Chris on? You should get Chris on sometime.
No, really sounds good. Wonderful. Yeah.
He used to work for Microsoft at IE, and he now works for Google on Chrome Evangelism. And you should get him on sometime to talk about web audio. That would be a fun.
So what would be, give me a scenario. I'm using Chrome, I'm browsing around, and suddenly I get to a site that supports this. What would it look like? What would happen?
Well, it can do anything you can do with audio. So it could be a synthesizer, it could let you remix things. There's the Infinite Songs. Have you seen that?
Mm-mm.
I probably shouldn't get you to play them on air because then you get the show taken down. But if you search for Infinite Jukebox, basically you can put a song in, it analyzes the song for beats. It looks to see which beats are similar, and then it will play the song and randomly cut between ones that are similar, so the song lasts forever.
I love it. Infinite Jukebox is called?
Infinite Jukebox. It's great fun. And you can upload arbitrary songs to it. But it's, you know, I think everyone hits it, it'll probably fall over. But it's fascinating to see that you can actually do that on the web with using web software. And that's the sort of the stage that the web audio has got to. So far, it's only Chrome and Firefox, I think. I'm not sure if it works fully in Safari yet, though. Some of it's in Safari because it was in WebKit.
So I just gave it Call Me Maybe, which I don't think anybody would argue is not long enough. But it analyzed it, and so it's going to just play this song forever.
Yeah, so if you hit the top and hit play.
Well, I'm not going to do that, but there's a visual of what's happening. Are these the – oh, you don't see it.
It's generating it.
You're doing yours, Chad. Do you not see mine at all?
I see yours fine, but
just the audio. You know.
Yeah, I just wanted.
So
to
what
see
happens
it.
After it generates it? These are the loopbacks, right?
Yeah. This is where it. So these long curves in the middle are where it connects one piece to the other piece, saying these are similar enough we could do the jump. And if you hit the top and hit play, it'll play around and sometimes it'll jump across.
Oh, go ahead, Chad. What the hell?
Okay, here we go.
But we have to listen to this. Skip ahead to where there's a loop.
Oh my God, I'm listening to it. It's incredible. Skip to another part of the song.
So does it jump back here or will it jump forward here?
It'll jump forward or back. Down. It'll do either. So it basically decides that two bars are similar enough that it can do the transition without you noticing. And then it starts doing
it. Okay, here comes one. Listen.
Well, it may or may not. You can...
It just shows you that it could if it wanted to.
Yeah. And then it takes it, and then they take it back again.
I love it. Those are the loops.
Yeah.
You can't force it to take that. I guess it'll do it at some random...
There it goes. Oh, no.
Nope. And they're back again. Yeah, yeah.
And we're back again.
Yeah. So with this one, you know, those two choruses probably are the same.
Yeah, see, we're playing at another part.
Yeah.
We jumped ahead with no evidence. Boy, you know, as somebody who spent a lot of years cutting music with razor blades...
Doing that by hand is quite fun.
That's pretty... I mean, I know exactly what they're doing, but that's impressive.
But, but it's, obviously with, a song like that is really easy because everything was edited...
Yeah, it's
like,
crap.
No, because everything was edited with tight bar boundaries and, and it's a drum machine and it's simple.
It's not sophisticated. But
I've done it with Pink Floyd's Time and that actually works.
That would be hard to do. Or a Mozart symphony. Okay, good. Well, that's impressive.
That's an example of the kind of thing you can do with this. You can actually play audio samples with enough precision to do sample accurate edits like that, and do things like that. And there's synthesizers. There's Chris built a vocoder, so you can actually give yourself a Daft Punk thing in the browser as you speak into a mic and things like that. So there's basically it's all the power of stuff you can do with digital audio, but now moved to the web layer. So that's one of these fun standards for me. It's like, oh, we can do great things with this.
So the HTML5 support in that example is the player is like in the markup you're saying play this audio from this point on. Like what's happening in the browser there
So you've got an API to play audio in different sequences and you've got a set of a filter chain that you can set up. You can write JavaScript. You can say play this and play this next, or you can write JavaScript that triggers and changes it.
Gotcha.
But you can also set up a whole filter chain that is just managed for you. So you're not trying to. You can filter samples in JavaScript by hand. There is an API that lets you get the buffers and do that.
Right, right.
What song is that, Chad? Nyan Cat. All right, let's see that. Apparently, it's quite a few jump points. Actually, whoever made Nyan Cat figured out how to do that. So that goes on.
Now it's back to the front.
Yeah.
You can see how little progress you're making.
Just look right back, like, oh, this.
Oh yeah, this won't ever end. Oh, now we're in the middle.
But also, you can notice they're all the same color because they're all pretty much the same sound.
Right.
We had a bit more of a spectrum with. So it's a visualizer and it's a sequencer.
So here's the thing. I mean, when I look at stuff like this, I go, gosh, technology's really swell. And we live in wonderful times. And then I think in some ways this is tougher for a creator because we're rapidly converging on infinite choice. And almost in a way, don't people really want to limit themselves? Why else would they make up sonnets, right, or haiku? They want the rules and then create within the rules. And as almost anything is possible, I almost feel like that's bad. I mean, I'm not advocating that we should get rid of all this stuff.
I don't know. I think,
I feel bad for kids today, though. There are limitless choices in front of them.
But that's how this like, makes old person. I've been having this old person, like, I just can't keep up. There's so much new to learn. I got to take some time, like 20% time where I just learn new things.
Right.
Because it just feels like there's so much new stuff to play with.
There is a skill that I think people are learning. I learned it myself, and I think people are learning, where you can say, I don't have to do it all. I don't have to read. It started with me with reading it all, right? Dave Weiner's talked a little bit about this. I don't have to read every article in my RSS feed. I can now dip into the river and dip out and not feel like, there used to be, for those of us, Kevin and my vintage, maybe not you, Gina, but
no, I have
first,
completism about
first,
it.
Yeah, and when we first encountered the internet, your first reaction is, oh, great, and I'm going to read it all.
Yeah, I blame Catholic school. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you realize, okay, A, it's impossible, and B, there's this nervousness that comes out of it, like, completionism, is that the word that describes it? That makes sense. Yeah,
completism. But it's but there's also the other weird thing is that you assume everyone's seen the same things that you have, which often isn't true, and the presumption that there is a shared context can be quite hard.
And that's valuable shared culture. We were just talking about Game of Thrones, and the fact that the three of us knew what we were talking about was very much a part of the conversation and important.
Right.
And that cultural common ground is really important.
But the other half of that is that you can now at least get it. So you were talking about kids in music. I've got teenagers who are 18, and I, for my son's birthday, I got him Ableton and a launch pad so he can do all this mixing.
Awesome. That's what I got for my son too.
But I'm looking back, when I was their age, I wanted to do synthetic music. I had to build my own synthesizer out of components,
right?
Because I couldn't afford to buy one because they were too expensive.
Then. Isn't that good in some way?
And I never got to the point where I had the mastery to actually be good at it. So I was sitting there trying to play with this thing going, okay, I understand what I want to do, but I don't actually have the musical mastery of rhythm to get this in the right place.
Yeah, but Kevin, the skill that you learned now has informed your career for the remaining 30 years. So
yeah,
maybe...
Oh. I found a little bit of a glitch, and I wanted to point out...
Why? Okay, the final countdown by Europe. It's in an infinite loop. I can't believe you even tried the final countdown.
Oh, yeah.
You can poke it, and it'll move. But
yeah, that's true. Poke it.
If you click somewhere else, it'll start again.
Yeah. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da.
Arrested Development,
Yeah. See, another cultural...
Yeah.
And what's funny is I had never watched Arrested Development, and so in order to keep up with the cultural thing, I have been mass consuming the earlier seasons so that I could be in this conversation.
Well, that's I hadn't either. I only saw that through Netflix because my son said, this is funny, you should watch this. Mm-hmm, I watched it last year, so now I haven't watched the new ones yet.
It's marvelous.
That's the other point. The other point is all this stuff is available. So
yes.
If I mention any musician, my son can go away and listen to their entire oeuvre and then decide what they like and which bits they like. Whereas before, we were stuck with it's on the radio or it's in the record shop. And that, so this is the anti-Yaron Lanier. Yaron Lanier says you can no longer hear a decade in music because the music is now touching the whole of history. And I think that's a wonderful thing. The fact that I'm not stuck with whatever happens to be fashionable at the moment is great. I don't have to listen to what this stuff is. I can dig into other things.
Yeah, I've done that. I mean, I started an audio lecture on the history of music, and I was able to go back and listen to Josquin des Prez and discover that and go from that. And then I put it into Pandora, and then Pandora discovered more. So you're right. I mean, it can inform you as well, and it can lead you, if you have that point of view. I guess that's the skill that people have to learn, is to choose. Because otherwise, it's like,
it is that infinite choice. Yeah, no, it is that infinite choice. Like, where to go next? Yeah. Like, just give me the next thing. But yeah, no,
so forget completism. Fun. No more anxiety over that. And then just choose. And I look at my daughter, who has not yet learned to choose, and the amount of anxiety she has from all the options available to her is debilitating. It stops her.
Yeah. Now, the trickiness and the place where there is a potential problem here is that... And I've heard this from people who teach literature, is that it used to be the library was the place you went and everything in the library was, vetted in a sense, right, both by the publisher and by the librarian. And so even though you had you couldn't possibly
that was the canon.
A library of books, there was a canon there and there was a sense that everything was there. Whereas now, if you just dip into the net and follow threads on the net, you are reading, you can very easily go into a spiral of Chad just had of like following links from people who reinforce each other and find that you are trapped in a corner where you think that Wi-Fi will kill your children and things like that.
You never get anywhere, or you go down a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I can't, first of all, it doesn't matter. Jaron Lanier can argue against it all he wants. It's happening.
Yes.
So probably the best thing would be to learn how to deal with it, because you can't stop it.
No, that's it. And that's the point. And then what you need to do now is teach, critical reading and this and all the things that you had to teach anyway.
Right.
You couldn't actually trust everything that was in the library.
Right. But you just thought you could.
but you had a full set, or everything's in the newspaper, everything's on TV. Obviously not. But you had this full sense obviously that's right, because that's that context.
Right. It's the canon.
And then there's this assumption that people believe everything they read. People now generally do bring a more critical sense of what they read to the internet, especially if they've grown up there. And it can be the older people who haven't had this as their formative reading experience, who therefore think anything in print must be true, that can get led astray by this sometimes.
Right. What a world. It's very interesting. And those of us, you haven't experienced this yet, Gina, but those of us with kids who have grown up as internet, digital natives... are watching with great interest to see what the hell's going to happen. And I can't imagine any more digitally native than your kids and my kids, Kevin Marks. Wow.
To some extent, yeah. I mean, that's true. I mean, Andrew was doing software testing when he was two.
Okay, I rest my case.
The funniest thing was that when they were sort of seven or eight, they assumed that I knew everyone who made every program because they'd done all of...
Well,
they, you know, they'd intuited from the fact that I gave them a bunch of things where I did know the people who'd made them.
Right.
And then they was like, there's a bug in this. You need to go and tell the guy.
That's so great.
Dad!
It's like, well, okay.
We're going to take a break. Our change log coming up. Kevin Marks is here. Gina Trapani. We'll talk about news. Yeah, sure. There's some news. Sure. Frankly, that's what the thing I love most about this show is it doesn't have to be about anything. It's a show about whatever we feel like talking about. Before we go on, though, to our change log and some good news, if you are looking for a Google Experience phone, another one in the mix. But first, a word from our friends at Ting, which is another example of a way the internet is changing everything. And if there is anything that needed to be changed more than the cell phone industry, I don't know what it is. If you go to twig.ting.com, you can take a look at this new company that is designed from the ground up to improve the experience of buying and using a cell phone. They are an MVNO. That's a mobile virtual network operator. They sit on top of Sprint. So if you have good Sprint coverage where you are, Ting is a very, very good choice. They're your month-to-month. There's no contract. There's no early termination fee. And best of all, there's no hidden bills, no strange expenses, no mysterious line items. You pay for what you use, no more, no less. Go to the Ting plans section, and you can actually design your plan. You start with how many devices you want. One of the things Ting's great for is shared plans, whether it's for your family or business. Let's say a family of four, Chad, that $6 a month for the phone. So that's the base. And then we choose how many minutes. Now, I think a family of four, nowadays people don't talk on the phone much. Let's make it 1,000 minutes. Here's why it doesn't matter if you get it exactly right. 2,000 text messages, though. That's make it four. Make it 4,000. We're going to talk a lot. And absolutely 3 gigabytes of data. That's just the starting point. Now, look, if you look at the pricing, that's $113? What does that say, Chad? $113, not each, for the family of four. That's the entire cost. But better yet, let's say you got the minutes wrong. They use more. It just goes up to the next tier. There's no penalty. Let's say you use fewer messages. They refund you the difference. More data, less data. You pay for what you use. No more, no less, without any penalties. No big ding, no big bill. Just cell phone service the way it ought to be. If you go to twig.ting.com, we'll give you a $25 credit to get started. Choose your device. Actually, you can apply it to the monthly service, too. And Ting does have a bring-your-own plan. So if you already have a Sprint phone, you should investigate that on the Ting website. They have nice illustrations. They have, it says shop around for a Sprint device or grab one from a desk drawer. So pick your device, an Android device. They have BlackBerry. They have a variety. Galaxy S4 would be a good starting point. But you can get inexpensive devices. They also have MiFi devices. They have used devices. So there's a lot of price points. There's the HTC One. That's kind of my favorite. $25 off gives you a great starting point. Now, these are not subsidized prices, so understand that you may want to shop around a little bit to get a better price or bring your own phone. But here, then you get the phone, and you go on to the website and you activate it. They've got a great dashboard, so you always know exactly what's happening. A no-hold customer support policy, which means when you call during business hours, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern, a person will pick up who is empowered to help you, to solve your problem. They're not going to put you on hold or say, let me transfer you. They're going to take care of it. They have great help online at help.ting.com, including active customer forums, video tutorials, startup guides, that kind of thing. This is how cell phone service should be. I want you to try it. Twig.ting.com, $25 off your first device or your first bill as a thank you for mentioning that you heard it on Twig. Twig.ting.com. Ting is changing the way we buy and use cell phones. I love that. You love your Netcast? How about your phone company? That's great. They're really great guys and gals at Ting.com. So let's play the trumpets, break out the horns, because it's time for the Google changelog.
The Google changelog.
Gina Trapani with what's new at the Google.
Google announced that it's adding nutrition information for over 1,000 foods to search results. It looks like this is going to be work for voice search only, and it's rolling out over the next few weeks. A couple of examples. You could say to voice search either on your mobile device or in Chrome voice search in your desktop, how many calories are in an apple? And Google will read the answer back to you. Or you can ask a question about ingredients, what nutrients are in breadfruit. I didn't even know what breadfruit was until I read this blog post.
You obviously never read Mutiny on the Bounty.
Yeah, I know. I didn't.
It's all about breadfruit, baby.
It's all about breadfruit. Yeah. Okay. You can ask how many carbs are in corn. This feature is only going to launch for English users and be rolling out to the U.S. over the next 10 days. And over time, they'll be adding more features and foods. So you tap the microphone and say, you know, how many calories in a banana?
Isn't
and
that
I'll
great?
Let you know.
I
yeah,
love
very
that.
Cool. They said it was a tough challenge. I haven't actually gotten this yet, so it's rolling out over the next 10 days. So I didn't get a chance to test it yet, but it looks like a really nice way to say, you know, hey, what am I about to stuff in my mouth? Which I need to ask more often before I dive in.
I actually ask Google that. What am I about to stuff into my mouth?
What am I about to stuff in my mouth? Gmail for iOS and Android are both getting the update that Google announced. I think it was last week during this show. This is the update that reorganizes your inbox into categories. It's 5 categories: primary, your primary inbox or primary category, social, promotions, updates, and forums. So the mobile apps are getting this right now. So you can opt into this. You can turn it off if you don't want it. Gmail for iOS is available in the App Store now. And actually, I believe The Verge just reported, Engadget just reported that it's rolling out for, it's showing up in the Play Store for Android as well. So the iOS version also gets new notification options. You can get notified for all messages, only important messages or none at all on a per account basis. And you can configure those in the in-app settings. And the Android version is also getting a sliding drawer with labels and an account switcher for phones and tablets, and also getting swipe down to refresh.
What do you think of the new Gmail?
So I was talking about this in All About Android last night. I gave the old college try. I turned it on last week during the show, and I tried to use it. I used it all week. I used it for about 6 days, but I'll tell you the truth. I missed stuff. I had mail land in other tabs other than primary. I found that I just got lazy and only was looking at primary because that was kind of became my habit because I had priority inbox turned on. So it became my habit that I sort of focused on priority inbox and then occasionally kind of pruned the rest. I only looked at primary and I missed stuff. Like, I'm on a lot of mailing lists for my open source projects, and I was missing those in forums and updates. I was missing like Twitter DMs and notifications and Facebook messages and social because I just stopped looking at those other tabs. So it didn't work for me. I can see how it would work for a lot of people. It just didn't quite work for me. And I was just so used to my priority inbox workflow that I went back to it and I was like, oh, thank goodness.
Yeah.
Back to a familiar place. So that's just me.
You can turn it off.
You can turn it off. Yeah.
Can you turn it off in the? I'm looking at the app. I don't. I think the app has to be this way.
You can turn it off in the app. I'm not sure about that. I mean, this is. I think that if it's turned off on the web, it's got to be turned off in the app, right? Because these are categories. They're not labels, which is a different different.
Yeah.
Thing,
I mean, and they're doing a lot of sorting, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Manage labels. I don't know.
You got the update there? Do you have this enabled?
It seems like it's just there. I would have to. Where do I go? Settings?
Settings, email account, and then inbox type.
Settings, email account.
And then you should get default inbox, priority inbox.
Inbox type, I see. It could be priority or default. Well, wait a minute. No, that's what we had before. That's what we had. That doesn't change the tab thing.
It does on mine.
It didn't on mine. I still get primary social promotions. All right, so Jason has a Nexus 4, so maybe. Oh, so you're not getting the.
I just turned it to that. I normally do this.
So show me. Okay, let's do it here. Menu, settings.
Go to your email account.
The specific account?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Inbox type, default inbox, or priority inbox?
You want priority inbox.
Okay. So priority is the new is the old way.
Exactly.
Got it. I still get all these tabs.
Are you in the right email?
Well, you still
you selected before.
Yeah. You still got a choice of labels, I think.
So they've made now social promotions, updates, and forms, but it's still not filtering. Is that the idea? And I have that new funny touch the picture. Jason's baffled. Baffled.
It gets rid of it for me.
I think it depends. Yeah.
Inbox categories. What?
Yeah, they're basically they are still labels. They just create labels for you and auto-filter certain types of things into those labels. So they're basically setting up a bunch of filters for you and
right.
labeling things.
So I think
doing archive first. So the kind of filters you've already built, they're automatically built for normal people.
I think we've tracked it down. Jason says he did not activate the new feature on his on his Gmail desktop. So,
right.
So because it's not activated on the email, he had the choice still on the mobile app. But as soon as you, I think, because I've activated on my desktop, as soon as I activate on the desktop, then I'm done.
You can't turn it off.
Yeah, I deactivated it in the desktop, and I do not have it in on my mobile app.
Okay, so
I
that's
sure
the way
that
to
was
do it.
Because I didn't get the update or because it turns it off. Yeah. But yeah, I think it probably matches one of the
I'm
other,
with you.
Which makes
it's
sense.
It's a little draconian. I mean, at least you can turn it off. I hope they keep that feature.
Yeah. I'm a little worried about Gmail. I'll be honest. Gmail's one of my favorite Google products, and it just feels like it's getting a lot of stuff. It's just a lot of features, and now there's a lot of different ways to look your inbox, right? There's the regular way. There's priority inbox. Now there's categories. You got categories and labels. We've got some plus integration. We've got the Hangouts integration. Like, it just feels like it's, you know, getting maybe just a little too heavy and complicated.
Yeah.
And maybe a little too many settings. I'm a little worried about it. I hope that Gmail. I mean, I don't want this forced upon everyone because I don't want it. I like having the choice of priority inbox, but it also makes me concerned that, you know, so many people are having such different Gmail experiences because it's so configurable.
I think we just changed at work from Exchange to Gmail by default, though not everyone switched over yet. And there's a huge amount of sort of confusion by people because they've built a workflow that they understand. And suddenly they're trying to reconstruct that workflow in Gmail and understand a different philosophy. And so it's, you know, suddenly like, I thought I deleted all those emails. Why are they still here? It's like, well, you don't delete them in Gmail. You archive them. It's and then you can search them again and don't worry about them. You know. And there's that sort of mental model of no, I want them gone.
That's quaint.
Changes when you get into Gmail.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and if you're used to Exchange, you're used to, oh no, I'm always being nagged about my mailbox being full. So you feel like you have to.
I would think you'd have a corporate policy that mail cannot be deleted anyway, right? I mean, for legal
reasons.
It's
the other way around. You have a corporate policy that mail has to be deleted after
a
certain time.
Has to be deleted. Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's like a rolling deletion, but there's logging as well, depending on what you're talking about. Sure.
I mean, I've always admired about Gmail that it's really required people to make mental leaps. Like, conversations was a mental leap.
Right.
Labels was a mental leap, right? Archiving was a mental leap. Like, you had to really change the kind of the way that you think about email. It's just that, now, I mean, that was whatever, 2005.
The thing that Gmail did originally was very good automatic spam filtering. So the first thing that... The value you got was there's no more. I don't spend half my day deleting rubbish.
And that's still true.
Right. And that's kind of what categories is doing. Yeah.
They're trying to say, okay, you've got a bunch of things and you don't have to read them all at the same time. Let's try and give you a bit of relief from that. And I suspect a lot of people will find that comforting. But it's people like us who've already like spent 5 years building mail filters to do that for us and have 35 tabs down the left-hand side for all our things.
Yep.
Going like, you just made some new tabs and things are where? The ordinary users may find this easier. I'm assuming they've done, Google is fairly good at user testing this stuff. I imagine, they've actually sat down with people and watched them use it and trying to understand them better now. But it is, if email is a big part of your workflow, it is very hard to have that transition forced on you. And it's very hard to, make the mental transition to maybe email shouldn't be the center of my workflow. Maybe that should just be the archive that documents everything. And I can use the other tools that feed stuff into email to be my workflow. And that's often a trickier thing to explain to people. Once they get it, it's like, oh, great. And Gmail is particularly good for that because Gmail acts as a good archive. So for me, it's I'll have conversations in various places, but I'll feed everything to Gmail through a filter that goes archive first. But then when I search, I've got somewhere I can search for things.
Yeah, that is the biggest leap, is not depending on email, but just knowing that you have this archive, you know, this living archive running all the time, for sure.
Finally.
Eric Schmidt doesn't use Gmail. You know that one?
What? He also uses a BlackBerry.
This dates back to Microsoft antitrust and the reaction to that. So he deletes everything because he doesn't want to be subpoenaed later. So he refuses to use Gmail. He only uses and doesn't have anything in his inbox. So when he gets subpoenaed, he's like, I don't have that. I can't recall.
There's something about telling about that.
And you know, there's bits of that in his new book. It's like, oh, we should be able to delete things. So he's, you know, despite
yeah, he said there should be a right to be forgotten. This whole controversial Neelie Kroes thing. He said, no, that's a good idea. Wait a minute. Oh, now I'm confused. I guess he doesn't really work there anymore, so he can say whatever he wants. Finally, a change to calendars.
Yes, we got to change the calendars. This is kind of nerdy. I love this because I think about calendar UI maybe more than you need to. But there's the Google Calendar app for Android has two new things: a new date picker.
They need a new date picker desperately.
Date pickers are the worst, right? They're just the hardest. They're so fiddly.
Roll those wheels.
It takes forever. Yes, rolling the wheels. It's so annoying. So this is a really nice upgrade. It's designed very nicely, and it's visual. So when you're choosing a date, you get a scrolling calendar that you can roll through and click on the date that you want. When you choose a time, you actually get a clock face, like an old school clock with hands, and you get to choose the time on the clock.
That's not going to work for anybody under 18 because they never learn how clock faces work.
What that clock face is like. And you can also set in the Google Calendar app for Android, you can also set assign colors. To go back to the date pick again, to set an event to repeat.
This is so much better.
You can repeat every week.
You get a calendar. Look, you could choose a date from an actual calendar. How novel is that?
I love it. It's so much nicer looking and easier.
So are these going to be OS widgets or are they Gmail?
To download. There's a generic Google Calendar app, which most Sense doesn't have.
These would be obviously lovely widgets for the HTML5 date picking UI.
Yes, yeah. That's
for example.
And for core
nice
Android.
Job.
Like, it would be nice date picker for core Android as well. You can also assign colors to events on a per event basis. So if you want to make an event tangerine or teal to make it stand out on your calendar, you can do that. There's a little
there's a palette.
Top right there.
I like that.
Yes. Yay. So these things make me happy. Was the example screenshot there that say Marissa Meyer's birthday? That's so funny. that's so funny.
She wants everybody to know. Don't want to miss that. October 17th, everybody.
It doesn't work there anymore. But yeah, that's fine.
Is it really? It does. It says Marissa Meyer's birthday. That's hysterical. What color is it? Gray?
It's green.
Green.
Surely it should be blue.
Well, that's hysterical.
That's Google operating system, so it's not an official Google blog, but it is very fun.
So it's them making fun, okay.
Right. Yeah, it's them poking.
Oh, it's not official. Oh, because that would be great.
That would be kind of funny. It should be purple is what it should be.
Yeah. Ooh, that would really be funny. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you make it purple. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all I got.
And that's the Google changelog. Come on, guys. Oh, come on. I just channeled Job there. Oh, come on.
Come on.
Fun stuff, as always. I like that changelog. I'm glad we do that. That's always good to see. I'll talk a little bit about the new HTC One coming soon to a Google store near you. But first, a word from our friends at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom's not a law firm. LegalZoom is a way for you to get legal documents done without the expense of a high-priced white shoe attorney. In fact, this is the greatest way. If you're just starting out, maybe you've got a new business idea, protect yourself with an LLC for $99 or incorporate S Corp or C Corp, $99. You can get a trademark done for $169 plus filing fees. If you've got kids, you really ought to have a last will and testament. Otherwise, the government decides what happens to your kids. The courts dispose of your assets. $69, you're protected. The thing is, you don't really need an attorney for these kinds of simple, really, it's almost just paperwork. You walk through step by step at LegalZoom.com. They have a questionnaire that will ask you what you need to, what it needs to know, and it'll generate the documents for you. Now, I did the LLC, and I have to say, we're still using that same LLC. But sometimes as you're going through the questionnaire, for instance, I was trying to decide what state to create the LLC in. I decided Delaware, but kind of randomly. You can use the LegalZoom legal plan and get advice from an actual experienced attorney at a set low fee. So that's really nice. That's peace of mind. You're getting some advice. You could choose your attorney by the profiles on the webpage, but also unedited reviews from customers. So you can really see the right attorney for you. I love this all around. LegalZoom.com. To give you a little incentive to use our offer code, we'll get you $10 off at checkout when you type in TWIG. And, you know, given the low fees that LegalZoom is charging, that could be more than 10% off. That's pretty good. LegalZoom.com. Start your business right. Protect your family. Get the stuff done you need to do without having to spend a lot of money on an attorney. That's why over the last 12 years, 2 million Americans, including me, have used LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom.com. Use the offer code TWIG. And we thank them so much for their support of this week in Google. HTC One will join the Galaxy S4, Googleized at the Play Store. The HTC One comes out June 26th with stock Android 4.2.2, $599 instead of $649. That's what the Galaxy S4 price will be. Now, I go back and forth, and I really can't decide which I like better. I have both.
I hope you'll decide this for me because I haven't bought either one
tough.
Yet. But I want to get one of them.
Neither is perfect. Battery life has been a problem on the One for me, although I talked about this last week. I found a XDA developers forum and post that gave some really good tips. I would recommend rooting it, and I did, and one of the reasons is...
Well, I was going to get the Nexus variant of either of them, so...
Ah, the problem with that is...
Because I want an unlocked one. That's the main reason.
Yeah, well, you can unlock it easily. In fact, HTC on their dev site gives you a boot unlocker, and then it's easy to root it. Unlocked, that's another matter. Unlock it easily?
I want to unlock so that I can take it to the UK and stick a SIM.
Yeah, AT&T unlocks it for anybody with an account in good standing, I think.
And also, I'm on T-Mobile. I want to reuse the SIM I've got. So it's I'm not going to be buying one without a thingy. So the developer one seems like a good choice. But
you're going to miss out, like, on the camera, which is one of the real reasons I like the HTC One. You know, it has that 4-megapixel camera, but also it has some nice features in the camera app, like the Zoe capability, and the ability to make instant highlight films is kind of cool, too. That's in the gallery app. And so that you won't get if you buy a Nexus. So I don't know what the answer is to that one. I'm not sure I can help you with that. The Galaxy S4, I don't think I'd miss the Samsung Cruft too much. Less so, anyway. But get the 32 GB. Will Google offer that?
I'll check.
Yeah, because the 16, there's nothing left.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there's about 8 gigs free, and you can put an SD card in, unlike the HTC One. Anyway, they're starting to push out 422 ROMs in Europe internationally, and I think that they will be coming to the U.S. And 422 on here, and they fixed some of the sense annoyances that people don't like. There's a battery meter that shows your percent left now instead of having to adjust that. They've got switches... the 422 style toggle switches, which I think you got to have on an Android phone. So it in many ways, I think it is a better. This is rooted, but running a Nova launcher, but still with HTC Sense on it. That's a tough choice. The Galaxy S4 has a lot to recommend it. Removable battery is and an SD card. That's big.
I never use a removable battery. I've got that in this one.
Oh, that's right. You have a Nexus 4, right? You don't care.
I've got the last Galaxy Nexus.
Yeah, I mean,
but it's crazy.
The issue with poor battery life is that it's ameliorated if you have more than one battery.
Yeah,
on the One, you got to get through
I
the day.
I carry around external batteries, so I'm kind of used to that one.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, I carry around external batteries, so that's nice. I'll just show you the highlight film. I've showed these before. This is my day today so far. So it does this all automatically. I don't have to do anything, and I just tap it. And then they have different choices of how to do it. This is doing the French version. So black and whites it and gives it a little kind of accordion music. but then I can choose other ones. They have more jazzy. If you want something a little more jazzy, just remixes it with new music. This is all automatic. Oh, I mean, that's, and you won't get that in the generic one, right?
Well, because, I could write that, but yes.
Now, I wonder if somebody, HTC says they won't, but if somebody at some point will extract the relevant code and make it available.
Should be doing it like they did with the extracting the Facebook thingy so that I can run it on here. Right.
I'm now having crows come out of my phone. I don't know. I must have accidentally recorded some of Kevin's audio. What the hell is that?
That's excellent. I actually need to do that because I've got a Twitter app that uses bird chirps to let me see when someone's tweeted, but I need different sounds for at replies and direct messages, so I need some crow noises for that.
I don't know what this is!
That would be a good text message sound.
I'm going to just reboot. I can't. I have no idea why my phone is making that sound. I can't stop it.
Now, I mean, you kind of changed my mind, Leo. I don't know. I still like having the kind of the vanilla Android.
Oh, it's
experience.
Vine. That's what it was. It was Vine.
Oh, it's Vine. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's why I was looping. Oh, well, one way to kill Vine, reboot your phone. You know, the good news is both the Galaxy S4 and the HTC One are excellent. They're neither perfect, but both are excellent. And we're going to see more. We're not done.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see this Motorola X phone. This has the potential of really being something, I think.
No, I think that is the transition that's fascinating, is that Android is now the world's dominant operating system. And that's a strange thing, but it is true. And that's the thing that is going to drive a lot of thinking in development over the next couple of years.
Although a little depressing according to the platform versions webpage at Google, 33% of Android users are using Jelly Bean, 36% are still on Gingerbread.
Yeah.
That is a significant difference.
But those numbers are moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 I mean, they're bigger than ever.
Yeah.
4.0 and up.
But
right.
that's relevant to you as a developer. I mean, you have to pay attention to that because...
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And look at Vine. It just came out for Android. It's 4.0 and up.
Yeah. It has to be. Mm-hmm. I think that's only fair.
I haven't actually tried Android Vine yet.
Are you pouring yourself a cup of tea?
I'm pouring myself a cup of tea.
Let me make a Vine out of that. That would be fabulous. I have mixed feelings about Vine. This is much like when Instagram came to Android, right? And all the Instagram people said, oh, no. Oh, and the Vine people are doing kind of the same thing.
The nice thing about Instagram on Android is at least you can see the photos. If you try and run it on an iPad, you get like this little tiny thing in the middle looks like crap.
Right.
So, $750 million, and they still can't make an iPad version of the app. It's pretty weak.
I don't buy into the fragmentation issues with Android, but it is fragmented. I mean, it is really all over the map.
It's fragmented, but the layout engine is better. iOS is fragmented now. iOS has six different screen sizes. It has two you can't tell apart at all because you can't tell the mini from the two.
Right.
But they have, you know, when you download an iPhone app on an iPad, it just feels wrong. It feels like you're doing it wrong.
Right.
Because they give you the, you know,
doesn't
the black
scale
borders
well.
Of,
yeah.
They give you the black borders of death, or they give you the everything zoomed up looking ugly.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's the mental model of the two is very different. So with iOS, you've got a little tiny thing in your hand that is really small and you operate with your thumb, or you've got this gigantic thing that you sit down to use because it's too heavy to hold up for more than 15 minutes. And they've only just now come up with the intermediate, you know, this sized one that is actually the good form factor. And they haven't made that fluid yet. So you're still running apps that were designed for something that's twice the size, and the buttons are all a little bit small on that. Or you're running the iPhone ones and their buttons are too big. They haven't got the fluidity. Whereas with Android, because they were all multiple different sizes to begin with, the app developers had to deal with it, and the layout engine was designed to deal with it. Whereas in iOS, everyone said, "Oh, there's only one size. Oh, there's only two sizes." And now there's, you know, six sizes and 12 if you count them rotated to portrait and landscape. And the app developers are, you know, banging their heads against the wall, and the tooling isn't there. But also there's this the more pernicious thing was the design sense that you build a mobile version. It's effect to the web as well. You build a mobile version of the app, or you build a desktop version of the app, and the iPad gets the desktop version, and the phone gets the mobile version, which makes sense on iOS, but didn't make sense on Android. And we had to suffer for a long time with, using a decent-sized Android, but you go to The Guardian and you get this like narrow column of type in the middle because they assume if you're on a mobile, you must be on an iPhone, and therefore you can't read it, more than eight words per line and things. So there's been this sort of weird dichotomy that is, because everyone who does design uses Apple stuff, their worldview of mobile was through that filter of that there are little tiny things, there are gigantic great big things, and nothing in between. And it's taken a long time for the actual reality of Android to work its way through to the design community and the way they're used. And that's happening now. We're starting to see it now. But there's still this sort of weirdness of the presumption is you've either got something really, really small or something, that's got a really big screen and not this fluidity between the two.
And really the way it's becoming in the Android world is there's every half inch there's this device that,
but also
from the G4 Mini to, all the way up to tablets.
But the thing is, if you've got something this big, the difference between holding it here and holding it here is quite significant in design terms, in visual design terms.
Closer versus farther.
And that depends a lot on whether what your eyesight's like. If you've got presbyopia, you cannot focus closer than here.
Right.
And you have to hold it that far away. So using an iPhone 5, if your near point is the length of your arm, is actually quite hard. Whereas with Android, you've been able to buy something with a bigger screen you can hold further away. So they've missed a big chunk of affordance there for a lot of people.
I'm very interested what Apple's going to try to do with we'll find out presumably next.
I'm assuming next week that we'll get some. They're not stupid. They'll have been working on this. They'll be thinking about this. They'll have some new way of doing layouts and apps. But it's definitely needed, because certainly on the web, we've got responsive design methodologies that work for this now. On Android, we've had the app layout stuff and the ability to add extra layouts so that you can do tablety things if you've got a tablet, but at least the thing will scale up. But on iOS, it has been fixed layouts for each type, and that's the develop. And what a lot of developers have done have written their own layout code rather than using the built-in interface builder springy things, because getting them to behave well was quite hard.
And that's always bad. By the way, Sundar Pichai, when he did announce the HTC One Nexus version at All Things D, also said, but we're still going to make hardware. So, and I presume that's under the Motorola brand, and everybody does seem to agree that there is a Motorola X. I think Motorola said there is one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Vine came out, as we mentioned, for Android, and that means now there are 13 million Vine users on the two platforms. This is very similar to what happened with Instagram, where they built it on iOS. And then as soon as it got, as big as it could get, then they released an Android version and it took it to the next level. Android's become the booster rocket. A million new users in 12 hours. Actually, that was Instagram. A million new users in 12 hours. I imagine Vine, we'll get the numbers, this is only a few days ago. But I imagine Vine had something similar. I know I downloaded it. Did you install it immediately? You did, right?
I did. I did install it. Although I have to say, I lost a little bit of my, when it first got released, there was a novelty to it. Right. I was seeing other people's Vines. I was really kind of jazzed and excited and bummed that I didn't have it on Android. And now it's been so long that I was just kind of like, oh yeah, this, whatever.
Yeah. We are fickle, aren't we? We are so fickle. Yeah. OMG Pop came out with Draw Something too, and and then Zynga. By the way, Zynga closed the office. They're done. Paid $180 million a year ago for Draw Something. And OMG Pop, out of business. Unbelievable.
And it's weird because they're saying they're focusing on mobile, and that was what that group was supposed to do for
them. It's a mobile hit.
Yeah.
Very strange. Very, very strange. iOS will be getting Google Play Music and All Access streaming soon, next couple of months, or next few weeks, I should say.
That's interesting.
It is interesting. Google Music.
No longer blocking them from doing that kind of thing is encouraging. That's good news.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing. Well, I wonder. I think that Apple probably would like to. But, they've been slapped around. What was it they blocked?
It was Latitude originally.
That Latitude.
The FTC judgment.
Right.
And possibly Voice as well.
Right.
Well, you can get it now. There's a third-party client, G Music.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah.
But it doesn't work very well.
It's not great. I want Google's. I want Google Music.
And, you know, Google now has a fairly solid iOS team who I'm sure deliver something nice, so that's good.
Yeah, their iOS apps are the best apps on the market for both iOS, and in some cases much better than the Android versions of the same apps. They obviously like their iPhones. Google put the kibosh. You nailed it, so to speak, Gina. The first-person point-of-view sex sites. Shortly after Gina announced that this would happen, My Candy.
I read a story from a third party. I didn't. There's.
She wasn't shipping an app.
I wasn't participating in any of this.
My Candy created a mobile app store for adult content on Monday, in which they encouraged people to upload. So few people have glass. I don't know if this is really going to work. To upload their first person sex videos and pictures. While wearing glass, and Google wasted no time in banning it. They announced that glasses terms of service do not allow erotica.
No sexually explicit content.
Explicit content.
Any device that connects to the internet and also does live streaming and takes photos and video. Like, there's
Good
plenty
luck.
Of Good sexually luck. Explicit content that's being communicated over glass. It's just they're just saying no to apps which are geared toward that, right?
And
many apps will enable that.
Right.
Chat roulette on glass.
And violence, bullying, hate speech, deceptive behavior, gambling, and outright illegal activities. All
and
illegal.
Facial recognition.
They said we will never do facial until protections are in place, we will not do facial recognition. Or
at this time, we're not doing facial recognition.
No, but this is. I don't understand this. So, Facebook does face recognition. Picasa does face recognition. Google Plus does face recognition. The camera apps on our Androids do face recognition. That's how they can decide whether you're smiling or not. You know, Vic just gave us an hour on how wonderful it was week before last.
Right.
So. To say, oh, we're not doing face recognition, it's got to be a snow job in some sense. I really don't get this. So what have they actually banned? Also, you can't write a face recognition app with what they've released at the moment because you have to send the things offline anyway. So they can't police what you've done once I send a photograph off to something else.
Yeah, Facebook will just do it for me. that's a very good point. I think that they just they want to dodge the bullet. At least for as long as they can.
Well, back in 2010 when they first did goggles.
Same thing. They said we won't do face recognition.
Tim O'Reilly got a version that had face recognition built in. He was running an alpha of it for them and talked about this. And then that disappeared after he mentioned it.
I think they're terrified
And it's, you know, I remember Eric explicitly saying that crosses the creepy line. But you know, that is a useful thing for...
Maybe you and I are just the most forgetful people in the world, but that's, to me, that's the number one reason I want glass.
We're old.
That's Kevin Marks.
Thank you.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
This is why people wear name tags at conferences. Like,
that's great.
Just virtual.
Well, Scoble wrote an article saying it doesn't matter because the issue isn't so much the recognition. The issue is, I'll figure out who it is, whether it's from a name tag or some other way. The real thing is looking that person up and getting the facts about that person. So it'd be nice. I would think it'd be nice to eliminate that initial step of how do I get that person's name. But I can understand why, from a privacy point of view, they're worried about. And Gina, you should speak to this about stalkers and creeps. And
but it's facial recognition. It needs a pool of faces to look at. So the way the facial recognition works well at the moment is explicitly with Picasa and with Facebook, which is like this is that person you already know. Picasa works well because you take lots of photographs of the same person and it will go, that's Kevin. Okay, those are all Kevin.
Right.
And you go, yeah, they're mostly me, except that one's Andrew and we look too similar.
Right.
It still does that.
One is a donkey and I don't know why it's in the list. Okay.
I got that from G+ last week where it was saying, this is you. It's like, no, that's my son, but well done.
That's good. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Is the issue a liability thing? Like, I remember when Twitter launched location attached to tweets. I was at the Chirp conference. I feel like this is back in like 2010. And Ryan Sarver was on stage and he said that they would fuzz the location after a certain amount of time. They stopped doing that at some point. But the issue was like, if Twitter knows that someone is in a particular place at a certain time, that they could potentially get subpoenaed or get a warrant for that. So like, so if you, you know, so if I'm out and about in public and I'm not broadcasting that information, but someone else has glass and recognizes me, now Google has knowledge that I'm in a location, right? Without me sharing that knowledge, right? It's like me and someone else. I mean, I guess that works with, you know, surveillance cameras, right? And I'm
that's
in public,
how...
but maybe we're in private. Maybe I'm in a bathroom. Maybe we're in my
home.
That would
be an
issue, maybe...
right?
So,
that's already a problem.
It.
You know, that's how Paris Hilton and Gawker, you know, make their living, is by people taking photographs of famous people in public.
Dr. Mom in our chat room says, well, it raises issues. What if you walk into a doctor's office?
Well, right, or a therapist's waiting room, or yeah, I mean, but the glasses are not just in public places, right? I mean, we're in sort of semi-private or places where there's some sort of expectation of privacy, like bathrooms or a doctor's waiting room or a funeral home.
I mean, right now, if you walk down the street, there's no legal prohibition in place for me saying, "Oh, there's Gina. I just saw Gina. She's right outside." That, I mean, they can't stop that. It's not illegal. And and I don't, maybe now I have assumed, you raise an interesting question, because maybe there is an assumption of liability for me tweeting that. And if something bad happens to you, am I liable? And maybe that's what Google wants to avoid. I think you might have.
And I wonder if that's part of it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, when, you know, they're tracking down criminals, they, you know, the easy path information, credit card information, public surveillance cameras information. But if does Google knows that someone was in a certain place, or like that had facial recognition in a certain place, you know, is that information?
Somebody on Twitter.
Well, Bruce Schneier just wrote a good article on this and what the FBI is asking for. I don't know if you saw that.
I love Bruce Schneier. Whatever he says, I agree with.
But he's saying the FBI are trying very hard to put in backdoors into everything so that they can potentially run, you know, audio recognition, image recognition, text recognition over all the
so
stuff
out
we're
of
sending. Which is, you know, it's Clipper all over again. If you're old enough to remember what that is, and now it's a card I use on the train, but in the 90s that was what got the EFF found in the first place. And that, you know, the notion is back that, oh, the internet is taking away our ability to intercept things, therefore we need to build in back doors. And the answer is no, you don't. We need to have some friction that stops you getting back doors. But guess what? If you get a subpoena, you can probably get access to a lot of the stuff we have, and then run facial recognition over it. But you need that ability to get a warrant. We don't want to feed everything that anyone ever does into a giant database, the NSA, that can then be compromised.
Well, and that's the issue that Bruce raises, is that any compromised security system is vulnerable.
Yes.
Just because you put, you know, the FBI can't have it both ways. You can't open it up to them and then say, but it's secure for everything else.
Right. Yeah.
He's writing it. It's on his blog, but he wrote it originally for the Foreign Policy magazine.
Foreign Policy thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
When it comes to, for glass, though, I mean, I think when it comes down to it, is glass is a serious PR problem, right? People think it's creepy. People misunderstand how it works.
Thanks to Robert Scoble.
Right. Well, partially thanks to Robert Scoble.
The creepiest person we know.
Larry Page really wanted to blame him. You could tell.
But although Robert, you know, was the first to say, like, look, like, I, you know, they're not on all the time. He's been trying to sort of debunk all the myths. Although, that shower photo didn't help. This is, but Google banning sexually explicit content and saying that they're not turning on facial recognition and even really not wanting to talk about the wink gesture. This is them just being extremely protective of a very new early platform. And just trying to shield themselves from any, you know, saying you don't wear it while you drive, like the laws don't exist yet, so just don't do it, and, you know, until the laws catch up. They're just being extremely protective, and they don't want glass to take any more dings than it's already taken in the creepy zone.
Yeah And I think they're probably right to be prudent, although I would love to see them load it up. let's get it all.
Turn on facial recognition. Just
I would love
picture.
That.
Yeah, just turn it on. Just do the whole thing.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, we live in a real world where you have to compromise, and there's you know, it's politics. That's the way it is. It's the way it is. Hey, let's take a break and come back. We can do our tip of the week. If you have a tip or anything you'd like to share with us, Kevin, Jeff usually does a number. So if you want to find an interesting number, go right ahead. As we continue with This Week in Google, our show brought to you today by our friends at 99designs. Somebody just wore our new T-shirt in here on Sunday, and I loved it. It was so beautiful. And we got it done on 99designs, which is really cool. It's a marketplace that brings great designers together worldwide, over 200,000 designers, together with people who need design help. And that's a lot of us, face it. You know, you may be a great programmer or web content creator, videographer, but you know, you may not have a great eye for design. Get together with a great designer and everything falls into place. 99 Designs connects you with those great designers. You tell them what you need. Dozens of designers from the 99 Designs community will submit their designs for you. You give them feedback. You iterate. You pick the design you want. And then you pay for your favorite. 24/7 customer support over phone, email, and chat. Complimentary design consultations with their San Francisco design team for all your branding needs. Look, at these are all the TWiT designs we got. The winning design is that one right there. Although, I have to say, we may use others of them. They're really beautiful. 100% money-back guarantee. And the prices are right, too. Logo design starts at $299. Web design at $599. Digital marketing collateral like landing pages or Facebook covers, banner ads, infographics, $199 and up. Print marketing collateral like flyers, menus, brochures, labels, greeting cards, $199 and up. T-shirts like the one we did, $199. Even mobile app design. We're working with them on a mobile app idea we have. Starts at $599. 99designs.com. Start right now to get your own custom graphic design. If you visit 99designs.com/twig, you'll get a $99 power pack of services for free. A power pack gives you more designer time and attention. 99 Designs will bold, highlight, and feature your design project in the 99 Designs marketplace, and you'll get nearly twice as many designs. 99designs.com/twig, or we have a special number for you, 800-513-1678. 800-513-1678. 99designs.com/twig. I got 99 designs, and a T-shirt ain't one. Or something. T-shirt is one.
The T-shirt one.
T-shirt one. Gina Trapani, you got a tool for us?
I got a tip.
A tip, brother. Today. Yes.
Yeah. I've been suffering from a little bit of Twitter overload. I'm following almost 1,000 people.
Yeah.
And I know. I still have that completest thing. I don't try to read all my tweets, but I find that I just sort of look at all the tweets flying by, and I go slack jawed, and I don't get work done. But luckily, Twitter just announced that they're expanding their list support. It used to be limited to, I think, only 20 people per list, and only. I have 500 lists per person. They've expanded that now. You can make up to 1,000 lists, and you can have up to 5,000 users on each list. So lists are a really good way to keep dip into a stream of people tweeting about a certain topic or related in a certain way without necessarily following them and have them clutter up your home timeline all the time. I know lists is kind of an underrated feature that people don't really talk about very much, but yeah. I really like lists. I have several private lists. I have a couple of public lists, and I think I'm going to break out some of my friends into lists or the people that I don't really maybe know personally or just kind of want to dip into a list separately. I think I'm going to do that. So go ahead and go crazy. Make some lists. Prune your follower list if you want, like I am, and you'll be able to do that now.
Yeah, I think lists are really of a greater benefit to other people than they are to you. You're giving a contribution. Mm-hmm. If I want to get tech news, instead of looking at my stream, I'll go to Robert Scoble. He has a list of tech great, you know, mm-hmm. big thinkers. He has startup, a bunch of lists. He really made a lot of lists. You just click that button, and now you're only seeing the people in that list. And it's a great way to really customize Twitter, as you said, temporarily. So make lists because it's useful to your friends and family and followers.
Yeah, keep them public really at least, right? Because if you have groups of people, like we can make Googlers lists or we can make hosts and guest lists. Lists are really great. It's true because there's a public signal. It's a public way of kind of categorizing other people, but then it also helps people kind of check out who you're.
It's curation. You're doing some really valuable curation for everybody else in addition to for yourself. Yeah. Mr. Kevin Marks, our number of the week.
Well, my number of the week is 62%. Which is the percentage of patent cases that were patent trolls in 2012.
What?
62%. 62%. Now, this is tied into this week's fascinating patent news. So there's been a bunch of patent stuff going on this week. There were both Planet Money and This American Life did patent shows this weekend.
They've done a great one on patent trolls a couple of years ago that was just wonderful.
This American Life was a follow-up to that. They did a follow-up to that, and they talked more about the case and about intellectual ventures. And because the case had actually settled and someone had defeated the patent and therefore not signed an NDA, they were able to disclose the details of the thing they talked in the first one. So the Planet Money one, This American Life one, if you haven't heard that before, let's do that again. But the Planet Money one was particularly fascinating for people listening to or watching this, which is about the podcast patent, which Leo tweeted out about the EFF helping to try and take this down last week, and people were donating money to it, and they've now got money, and they're gathering
a huge amount of money. I'm so glad they did that.
Julie said they had 65,000 this morning. They did a hangout about this,
which is
awesome. Good.
That's Julie Samuels, who is the Mark Cuban chair for ending stupid patents. Thank you, Mark Cuban, for endowing that chair. $67,000 donated from 1,165. They were looking for $30,000. They made their goal in 10 hours. Yeah. By the way, when I saw it, and it was just a few hours in, I immediately gave them $2,500 because this potentially could save us a lot of money in litigation.
If you haven't listened to the Planet Money one, you should listen to that, because they actually found the guys who filed the patent and interviewed them and, you know, talked through what they were doing. And it was...
Were they justified in their mind?
In their mind, they were. But the weird part. So the thing is that, you know, the test for a patent is this obvious to someone who understands the field? And what was completely clear with this interview was they didn't understand the field at all. They were making cassette tapes that they were mailing out to people that were recordings of things, and they thought, oh, we should do this on a computer somehow. And they wrote this like rambling spec that doesn't make any sense, and then turned it into a patent rather than a product. And then didn't touch, you know, the idea of remote audio for 15 years, and then said, oh, we have a patent on this. Let's go and take everyone down.
Yeah.
So the patent, you know, the patent is laughably defeatable, I think. You know,
EFF has decided to do, at least with this particular podcast patent, there's a number of ways you can defend it. Yeah. Of course, you can go to court, and that's a little risky and very expensive, millions of dollars.
Yes.
Or you can do something called an inter partes appeal, where you go to the patent office and you say, hey, look, here's all this prior art, or here's why it's obvious or trivial. And then the patent office has the will re-examine. And if you're proven to be accurate in your assessment, we'll throw out the patent, and that throws out all of the cases immediately. So if you go to EFF.org and look at this, they have a link to the Stack Exchange.
Yes.
Ask patents, where they're showing you what the patent in this particular patent we were talking about,
and the particular claim that they're trying to
claim 31, which is the key claim. Yeah.
It is basically, you know, Gopher invalidates it, FTP invalidates
right.
it. It's, you know, there is a list of things on the internet, and you can download some of them, and the list may change over time.
So this is kind of neat, because
Usenet invalidates.
They've got 65 people, and I would encourage you, if you have expertise in this area, or you know, have some history, it needs to be something that was done before 1996. Add to the comments here, and lots of people showed up with prior art. So now it's up to EFF to spend that $65,000 to organize a challenge and bring it to the USPTO. Yeah.
But the other part of this that is also fascinating is that the cultural storytelling is really important. This is why Planet Money and This American Life are valuable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've had this classic patent narrative for, you know, 100 years, which is there's a lone inventor in his shed who comes up with this brilliant idea and needs protection from malicious corporations who would try and steal it from him. And this is, you know, that is the cultural narrative of invention. That's what the patent system is designed to defend. And we have movies and all kinds of things that show that worldview. And that stopped being true sort of 40 years ago And it became, you know, massively, obviously untrue in the last 10 years, because if you invent something now, what you do is you build it and you take it out there and show it to people, and the corporations don't have the ability to stop you from showing it to people anymore because we have the internet.
Right.
But also you can share the primary purpose of the patent office was to get people to disclose inventions rather than keeping them secret,
right,
so that other people could build on them.
Right.
And it no longer serves that primary purpose.
So what about what the White House...
No one in software would think of looking in the patent database for an algorithm, because we have GitHub, we have Google, we have Stack Exchange, we have, you know, the universe of the internet, which was built for information sharing by physicists to share their data, and is now used to, you know, share how we do things. we've built the culture of open standards, which the web is built on, where you explicitly have to say there is no pattern on this, or you get thrown out of the W3C, or you have to say, I will license this reasonably, we get thrown out of the ITF. And we have the open source world, where you're explicitly saying, I am giving this code and you can reuse it. And that's, so we've now built this disclosure model where every, the voluntary disclosure model that actually builds the infrastructure that everything that we use runs on. And, you know, with Android being the dominant operating system, that now means that we have a dominant operating system that is built on this culture. Chrome is a dominant browser, and the, you know, the second place one is Firefox. So we have a plurality there where, and, you know, and the other one that's ranking, you know, there's IE, which is still closed. And then there's Safari, which is built on WebKit, which is all open source. So, you know, we now have the proprietary one pleading with people to make sure they support the standards so that they work too. So we've won in the web world completely, and the computer world and all the stuff we use and talk about on this show is built on this shared culture of disclosure and competing with each other on what you're building, not on how you build it, or how, you know, what your infrastructure is. And the patent office is stuck in 18th century, 19th century, with this presumption that you take to the government office and file it, and that gives you a monopoly, and that's the value. And so what's happened is the people who are doing this patent trolling tend to be the people who weren't very good inventors. They didn't make something very smart, or they didn't tap into this culture, and instead they wrote down a patent and, you know, filed it and then didn't make a company and disappeared off and did something else. So both the examples in the Planet Money show and in the This American Life show are inventors who fit that model. They came up with an idea. It wasn't particularly well thought through. They clearly didn't investigate what else was going on, but they wrote a patent up. And then, you know, 15, 18 years later, they start, somebody else encouraged them to start a lawsuit because someone has had a similar idea and they think that their particular bad implementation of something is the same thing, which it clearly isn't. So that's and the problem is that previous cultural narrative of the lone inventor whose idea was stolen is still there, but we now have a nice counter narrative of the rapacious patent troll who is now trying to steal innovation and take it over. And the irony is that metaphor was invented by one of the guys who's now a VP at Intellectual Ventures.
Oh, really?
That's in This American Life.
I'll have to listen.
But the one that got me was the White House doing a...
Gene Sperling.
The White House Tumblr having an animated GIF of a giant troll attacking people.
The White House is really taking this on. And actually, I'll give a little credit to Lady Ada, Limor Fried of Adafruit Industries, because in a hangout with the president a few months ago, she asked him about this.
Yes.
And he talked a little bit about it. I guess it was in February. And now, just a couple of days ago, the White House posted this article on whitehouse.gov, released a study that documents the toll that patent trolls take on innovation, some executive actions. I don't know how effective they are. I'm not an expert on this stuff. And they're asking Congress to take some legislative action as well to protect innovation. And I think it's really good, at least the leadership coming out of the White House. I hope it's more than just words, that it can make a difference in all this. Because according to this post by Gene Sperling on the whitehouse.gov site, $62 billion that would have otherwise been invested, I'm sorry, $29 billion that would have otherwise been invested in innovation was paid to patent trolls in 2011. And that's a 400% increase from 2005. So that's a big cost. And look at the number of patent troll cases.
Yeah.
You know, the patent trolls will dispute it. They'll say, we're not trolls. What are you talking about? We're just defending the little guy.
Now, this is partly an effect of the American Invents Act, which made it harder to do a giant class action. So you used to be able to say, I'm going to do a suit against everyone who infringes this patent.
Now you have to do one by one.
So that's creating more cases. And that's made revealing this. And it's starting to gum up the court system. And so the judges are now getting cross with this abusive process, which is good. It's making that abusive process visible.
Well, let's hope. Let's hope. Because it does clearly take its toll on startups, on innovation and invention. So much is done. I was talking to the SwiftKey guy yesterday. And Samsung uses a SwiftKey keyboard on their Samsungs, but it doesn't have all the features of the downloadable SwiftKey because Samsung's afraid of getting sued. And you see this over and over again.
Wow.
Yeah. where companies just don't do the best they can because they're so afraid of these suits.
That's a bummer.
Isn't that sad?
Yeah.
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 Yeah, and users get, that stinks.
thank you, Kevin Marks. You're the greatest. I really appreciate your being here. Jeff Jarvis will be back, I think, next week. and if not, will you come back?
I'll come back.
That's great. Loved having you on.
Thanks. With your crows.
Yeah, with you and your crows, your black crows. Bring them back. Thanks also to Gina Trapani, who was, of course, a regular on the show at smarterware.org. That's her blog, thinkup.com. That's her software. Todotext.com. That's our other software.
New update this week. Go get Android App Play Store.
Yay.
New widget.
I'll download.
Excellent.
Thank you for joining us. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday afternoon, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 2100 UTC on twit.tv. Watch live, please. Please. We love it when you watch live. But then you should also download the show so you can listen again and again and again. We're available on demand at twit.tv/twig. And wherever podcasts are aggregated, like iTunes, that's always a good place to get us. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.